I bet if I just hum three specific notes, I can trigger a very specific image in your brain. The sun will come out.
Oh, yeah. And just like that, you know, you were picturing a bright red dress, a curly wig, and probably a very shaggy dog. It is just instant recognition.
It really is. We are talking about Annie today. And I know what you were thinking. You were thinking, okay, sure, the cute musical about the orphan, it gets filed away in our cultural cabinet as this incredibly sugary, simple piece of children's entertainment.
Which is ironic because when you actually peel back the layers of the source material, Annie is anything but simple. It is actually kind of a mess of contradictions.
Right. Beneath the catchy tunes and the tap dancing kids, we're talking about a story deeply rooted in political propaganda, brutal Dickensian realities, and frankly, a surprising amount of backstage Broadway drama.
Drama that would make a reality TV star blush. It really is a fascinating collision of eras. I mean, you have a character from a conservative 1920s comic strip reimagined by liberal 1970s creators to comment on the Great Depression of the 1930s. It is a lot more complex than just a song about tomorrow.
So that is our mission for this deep dive. We are going to unpack how this comic strip was transformed into a massive political commentary. We are going to look at the ruthless casting controversies that plague the production history.
Seriously, they were firing kids left and right.
Yeah, it was wild. And we are definitely going to talk about the novelizations.
The novelizations are absolutely wild.
They turned this story into a grim, gritty nightmare that most casual fans have zero idea about. So, buckle up.
We have a really great stack of sources today. We are looking at production histories, detailed Wikipedia breakdowns of the musical's evolution and adaptations, and specifically the writings and novelizations by Thomas Meehan.
Right, he wrote the book for the musical.
Exactly.
Let's start at the very beginning, because Annie did not start on stage. It started in the funny pages.
Correct. It is based on Little Orphan Annie, which is the comic strip by Harold Gray that launched way back in 1924.
Wow, right.
But the musical does not really get going until 1972. That is when lyricist Martin Sharnan approached writer Thomas Meehan. Sharnan had this idea to make a musical out of the strip.
And Meehan's reaction was not exactly enthusiastic, right? I mean, comic strip musicals were not exactly a guaranteed hit back then.
Not at all. Meehan was very skeptical, but you know, he did his due diligence. He went back and reread prints of the old comic strips, just looking for a story to adapt, and he hit a major wall.
What happened?
He found absolutely no usable material for a musical plot.
That is wild to me. The strip ran for decades. How could there be no material?
Well, think about how comic strips worked back then. They were highly episodic adventures.
Right.
Annie would get into trouble, usually involving spies or kidnappers, and then Daddy Warbucks would swoop in to save her. And he usually delivered a lecture on the virtues of capitalism and self-reliance along the way.
So it was just repetitive.
It was a loop. There was no emotional arc at all. There was no act one, act two, act three structure. Meehan realized that aside from the core trio, you know, Annie, Oliver Warbucks, and the dog Sandy, that there was nothing there he could use.
So he had to invent his own story from scratch.
He did. He realized he needed a totally new narrative.
So he has these characters, but no plot. How does he actually land on the story we know today?
This is where the cultural context gets really interesting. Remember, this is the early 1970s. The team, Meehan, Sharnan, and composer Charles Strauss, they were all New Yorkers living through the Nixon era.
Right. The Vietnam War is happening. There's the Watergate scandal brewing. It is a very heavy time in America.
Exactly. It was a downbeat mood, as Meehan described it, and he saw a parallel. He decided to set the story in New York City during the Great Depression, specifically 1933.
Oh, I see.
He felt that the gloom and cynicism of the 70s perfectly mirrored the gloom of the 30s.
So the setting was a completely deliberate choice to reflect the audience's current reality.
Yeah.
They were essentially using the 30s to talk to the 70s.
Precisely. And Meehan had a very specific literary ambition. He saw Annie not just as a comic strip character, but as a 20th century American female version of Charles Dickens's Orphans.
Oh, like Oliver Twist.
Or David Copperfield,
That
exactly.
makes so much sense. The mystery of her parentage, the harsh institutional conditions is very Dickens.
And that structure allowed them to build a story that was not just about a cute kid, but about a country trying to recover from total economic collapse. It gave the optimism actual stakes.
Let's walk through that plot, because even if you know the movie, The stage show has some specific beats that really highlight this political angle. Act one is just pure misery.
Right. It is 1933, the orphanage. You establish the hard knock life immediately. You have the villain, Miss Hannigan. And it is worth noting, in the script, she is not just mean.
No. Okay.
She is described as a disillusioned matron who actively hates children and is very fond of alcoholic beverages.
A great combination for child rearing.
No.
But she is also a victim of the depression, in a way. She is stuck.
She is stuck. She represents the pure cynicism of the era. Anyway, Annie escapes, finds Sandy, and they end up in a Hooverville.
A shanty town under a bridge.
Exactly.
This is one of those moments that feels very heavy for a kid's show. You have formerly well-off people living in literal shacks.
And they sing, "We'd like to thank you, Herbert Hoover." It is incredibly sarcastic. They are toasting the former president for ruining their lives. It really grounds the show in real poverty. If you did not have the Hooverville scene, the rest of the show would just be fluff.
It creates a stark contrast when Grace Farrell shows up. She is the assistant to the billionaire Oliver Warbucks. She takes Annie to the mansion for Christmas.
And there is friction there, too. Warbucks was not expecting Annie.
Right. He assumed all orphans were boys, which says a lot about his worldview.
He is a titan of industry. He views everything as a transaction. He ordered an orphan for the holidays like he would order a turkey. When a girl shows up, he feels like the order was messed up. But then you get that classic turning point where he takes her to see the city, the song NYC, and he starts to soften.
But the real meat of the story, the political core that we found in the sources, happens in Act Two. This is the part that always surprises me when I revisit the show. Annie literally goes to the White House.
She does. Warbucks brings her to Washington, D.C. to meet President Franklin D. Roosevelt. And this is crucial. Annie is not just a prop in the scene. She stands up in the cabinet meeting and sings "Tomorrow."
And the cabinet members, Cordell Hull, Francis Perkins, they all join in.
They do. And it is not just a sing-along. The musical explicitly suggests that Annie's optimism is what inspires FDR and his cabinet to commit to the New Deal.
Wow.
The show draws a direct line from this orphan's attitude to the economic recovery of the entire United States.
Now, and we want to be very clear to you listening, you're not taking any political sides here, left wing or right wing.
No, not at all.
We are just impartially reporting on what the musical's text actually says and what the sources outline. But wow, that is a lot of pressure to put on an 11-year-old. Fix the economy, kid.
It really is. But it creates this fascinating dynamic where the solution to the Great Depression is a collaboration between a billionaire industrialist and a socialist-leaning president bridged by a child.
It is the ultimate centrist fantasy. Mm-hmm. The rich guy and the government guy just need to be nicer to each other.
Exactly. And while all that high-level politics is happening, you have the B-plot with Rooster and Lily St. Regis.
The Easy Street crew. They pose as Annie's parents, Ralph and Shirley Mudge, to get the $50,000 reward Warbucks puts up.
Which leads to the climax. The FBI steps in, thanks to J. Edgar Hoover, because Warbucks has friends in high places, and they reveal the fraud. Annie is adopted, and everyone gets a new deal for Christmas.
It is a very tidy resolution on stage, but getting to that polished product on Broadway was anything but tidy. The production history is filled with what you might call hard knocks.
Oh, I see what you did there. But yes, the casting process was brutal. Let's talk about the Annie we know versus the Annie we almost got.
This goes back to the pre-Broadway tryout at the Goodspeed Opera House in 1976. The original actress cast as Annie was Kristen Vigegaard.
Right. She had the job. She was rehearsing. She was performing. By all accounts, she was a lovely actress with a beautiful voice.
So what happened?
The producers felt her interpretation was genuinely sweet. And they realize that was not right. Annie needs to be a survivor. She needs to be street smart. She is living in a hellhole orphanage run by a drunk tyrant. She cannot just be sweet. She has to be tough.
So they fired the sweet kid.
They did. After a week of performances, they replaced Vigegaard with the girl who was playing the tough orphan, Pepper. That was Andrea McArdle. She brought that grit, that belt, to the role that became absolutely iconic.
Talk about a promotion. Hey, you are not the sidekick anymore. You are the star.
And it was not just Annie who got recast. Miss Hannigan went through a major shift, too. The original actress, Maggie Cask, was apparently playing the role very realistically, meaning she was too mean.
Too mean? For the villain?
Well, there's mean, and then there's unwatchable. If you play an abusive alcoholic matron too realistically, it stops being a musical comedy and starts being a tragedy. They needed someone who could balance the villainy with actual entertainment.
Enter Dorothy Loudon.
Exactly. Producer Mike Nichols suggested her. She came in and really found the humor. In fact, she reportedly improvised some of the most famous lines in rehearsals. You know the line, "Do I hear happiness in here?"
Classic.
That was Loudon improvising. She made Hannigan a character you love to hate rather than one you just wanted to call the police on.
It worked. The show opened on Broadway in 1977 and was a massive hit. It won 7 Tony Awards, including Best Musical. It ran for nearly 6 years.
But the drama did not stop with the original production. Fast forward to the 20th anniversary revival in 1997. This story is just uncomfortable.
This is the Joanna Pacitti story. I remember reading about this.
It was a PR nightmare. This was the Annie, the 20th anniversary production. Macy's sponsored a huge contest to find the new Annie. Thousands of girls auditioned. Joanna Pacitti won. It was highly publicized. She was the one.
A literal dream come true.
Until it wasn't. The show was in previews and touring before Broadway. Pacitti got sick with bronchitis, which happens to theater kids constantly, and she missed a few performances. Her understudy, Brittany Kissinger, stepped in.
And Kissinger was younger, right?
She was 8, the youngest Annie ever on Broadway. And she had this manic energy that the producers suddenly decided they liked better.
I think I know where this is going.
2 weeks before the Broadway debut, while Pacitti was still battling bronchitis, she was fired. The production replaced her with the understudy, Brittany Kissinger.
That is cold, firing a sick child after a nationwide contest.
It was perceived as incredibly cruel. Public sentiment was very much on Pacitti's side. The cloud over the casting really hurt the production. It doomed the revival to a short run. You just cannot be seen bullying the orphan in real life.
And that was not even the only controversy in that 1997 production. You had the legendary Nell Carter playing Miss Hannigan.
Yes. Now, this is a sensitive situation. Nell Carter is a black woman. But when the commercials aired promoting the show, they used footage of a white actress, Marcia Lewis, who had played Hannigan in a previous production.
Wait, so they were selling tickets on Nell Carter's name, but showing a white woman on the TV screen.
Exactly. The producers claimed it was strictly a budget issue, that it was too expensive to reshoot the commercial. But Carter felt that was erasing her presence. She told the press, "Maybe they do not want audiences to know Nell Carter is black."
Did she quit?
She did not. She later released a statement clarifying that she never accused the producers of racism directly, but she maintained it was insulting to her as a black woman. It just shows that even with a happy show, the machinery behind it can be filled with friction.
It is amazing how much tension can exist behind such a cheerful show. But if we want to talk about dark, we have to move on to the novelization.
Well, this is my favorite part of the research.
So Thomas Meehan, who wrote the book for the musical, wrote a novelization in 1980. And apparently he decided that the stage show was just too soft.
He really did. He used the novel to restore all the material he had to cut from the stage show. And he leaned heavily into that Oliver Twist inspiration. The tone is significantly grittier.
Give us some examples. How different are we talking?
Yeah, let's look at Miss Hannigan again. In the show, she is a funny drunk in a silk robe. In the book, she is described as a skinny, hatchet-faced woman who looks like a Halloween witch.
That removes the campy fun immediately.
It does. The book details brutal beatings. It describes the emotional abuse in a way that is not played for laughs. It emphasizes the illegality of the sewing labor the orphans are forced to do in the basement. It is presented as a literal sweatshop.
And the plot changes, too. In the musical, the kids are kind of isolated in the orphanage world.
In the novel, they go to public school PS62, and this adds a whole layer of social trauma. Because they are orphans, they face terrible snobbery and bullying from the non-orphan kids. There is a specific character, a rich girl named Myrtle Vandenmeer, who torments Annie.
That adds a class warfare element that you do not really see on stage. It shows that the world outside the orphanage is just as cruel.
Exactly. And speaking of class, the Hooverville section is different. In the show, you have cute kids and ensemble actors. In the book, the characters Sophie and the apple seller are adults. They are a couple. The apple seller is actually a former stockbroker named Randy who lost everything in the crash.
So it humanizes the depression victims even more. It is not just the poor, it is the formerly middle class.
And Warbucks' role at the end is bigger. He does not just adopt Annie, he hires Pinkerton agents to find Sandy, and he actually gets the Hoovervale residents released from prison. They were arrested for vagrancy and gives them jobs. It is a much more comprehensive savior moment.
It is interesting how the story shifts depending on the medium. The stage show needs to be bright and loud, but the book allowed for the shadows.
Okay.
Speaking of mediums, Annie has had a massive life beyond Broadway. The movies alone are a whole saga.
The 1982 film is probably the one most people of a certain generation know. Columbia Pictures bought the rights for $9.5 million.
Which was a record at the time, right?
The most expensive musical rights ever at that point. That is the version with Albert Finney and Carol Burnett. But strangely, they cut NYC, which is a huge number in the show. Instead, they added new songs and a climax involving a helicopter and a bridge that definitely was not in the stage show.
And then Disney took a crack at it in 1999.
With a powerhouse cast. Kathy Bates as Hannigan, Victor Garber as Warbucks, and Audra McDonald as Grace. And that version is generally considered very faithful to the stage show.
And more recently, the 2014 remake, produced by Will Smith and Jay-Z.
Starring Quebensani Wallace. That one updated Warbucks to Will Stax, played by Jamie Foxx. But you mentioned Jay-Z. His connection to Annie is actually really important for the show's legacy.
Because of Hard Knock Life.
Right. In 1998, Jay-Z released Hard Knock Life Ghetto Anthem. He heavily sampled the original Broadway cast recording.
Which, on paper, sounds like a disaster. A hip-hop anthem sampling a show tune about orphans.
But it worked perfectly. Jay-Z recognized that the themes were identical. It is about the hustle. It is about starting from the bottom. That song became a massive hit and introduced the hook to an entirely new demographic.
It is impossible to hear that song now without head bobbing. It's cemented Annie in pop culture in a way few musicals manage.
You see it everywhere. Austin Powers in Goldmember has Dr. Evil and Mini-Me performing the Jay-Z version. It became a cultural shorthand.
And then there are the darker parodies. Because the show is so optimistic, people love to subvert it.
Oh, absolutely. John Waters' Serial Mom. There is a scene where the killer is bludgeoning a victim with a leg of mutton while watching the 1982 film and singing along. It uses the sugary nature of Annie to make the violence seem even crazier.
And Reefer Madness the musical.
That one is hilarious. They have a parody where FDR shows up at the end, Deus Ex Machina style, just like an Annie. But he mocks the idea of taking economic advice from a little orphan girl. He says something like, "Her adopted father was a powerful billionaire, but now, by gum, I think she may have been onto something."
It is funny because that parody points out the inherent absurdity of the plot we discussed earlier.
It does, and that brings us back to what this show really is. It is a unique blend. You have the actual history of the 1930s filtered through the cynicism of the 1970s wrapped in this timeless optimism.
It is a show where a billionaire and a socialist president find common ground because of a child.
Exactly. And that is a very specific American fantasy. The idea that if we just smile hard enough and work together, the sun really will come out tomorrow.
So, as we wrap up this deep dive, we like to leave you with something to think about. When you really look at the ending of Annie, the problem of the Great Depression is solved. But how?
It is solved not just by government policy, but by the benevolence of a billionaire, Oliver Warbucks, who adopts the very symbol of poverty, Annie.
So the question to ask yourself is this. Is Annie ultimately a story about the triumph of the human spirit and optimism? Or is it actually a fantasy about how the wealthy should step in and save the world?
It is a question that makes the New Deal for Christmas feel a little more complicated. Are we rooting for the system, or are we just rooting for a rich dad?
Definitely something to chew on the next time you hear tomorrow. Thanks for listening to this deep dive.
See you next time.